cultural programming, and that's why it's more important than ever for you to support this station now at WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org. If we have to make painful cuts, it will have a negative impact on our whole region. It'll affect the many local events, businesses, nonprofit organizations that we support on air. It'll affect our ability to bring local voices on air to voice local concerns. So please, do what you can. Help us out during our summer fun drive. Go to WJFFradio.org, make a donation, and if you can, spread the word. Share the link. Tell your friends and family we need their help too. Donate now at WJFFradio.org. Again, that's WJFFradio.org. Thank you so much. This is Radio Catskill.
Pregnancy
support comes from Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and grill on Main Street in Jeffersonville, featuring local American fare, Saturday and Sunday brunch, and Thursday trivia nights. Menu and hours online at tavernonmainny.com.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.
Live as live can be from Radio Catskill Studios right here in Liberty, New York. This is nothing other than the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me.
And I'm Patricio Robayo.
Thank you for being here with him, too. And we've got a great show for you because Patricio wanted to know, is the U.S. president above the law? So we talked to Michael Kirk, award-winning filmmaker, founding producer of Frontline. His latest documentary is called Trump's Power and the Rule of Law. It debuted just last night. Patricio Robayo has that conversation coming up in just a bit. We have important reporting on the state of mental health care in New York State. And for that, we are lucky to have one of our reporters, Julia Kim, did a special report on that. But before we hear the report, we have on the phone, actually, that reporter, Julia Kim, joining us now. Julia, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You're live on air with our listeners during the local edition.
Great.
Well, I want to thank you so much for the work that you've been doing with us this summer.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, I've had just an amazing time interning at Radio Catskill and being able to report on these really important local stories, especially because it seems like the news is never ending these days.
Yeah, and just last night, if you're a regular listener to the show, you might have heard the Forge Project interview, which is like an indigenous art initiative in New York State, and that was also, Julia, that was also your work last night as well. What struck you as the most interesting thing about talking to those Forge Project folks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was so interesting because, as you know, the Hudson Valley has its own art history. You know, it has this legacy of, you know, romantic landscape paintings, you know, that depict the natural landscape that, you know, this region and the Catskills is so famous for. But, you know, the Forge Project is really challenging that legacy. It's really challenging that narrative that has often come at the cost of, I mean, that has come at the cost, you know, of indigenous communities, you know, within the Hudson Valley and then obviously across the country and throughout the world as a whole. And it was just amazing being able to talk to them, to members of indigenous tribes within Canada and the United States, and to hear their perspective on the necessity of challenging these subtle colonial narratives, especially because We don't often think of arts and culture, maybe, but it really does influence how we view ourselves, how we view others, how we view our communities. And yeah, it was just amazing to talk to them and to see the work that they've been doing in terms of really supporting contemporary Indigenous artists and really pushing back against that narrative that Indigenous people are people of the past, when in fact they're very much here.
Well, yeah, and if you missed that, the feature interview, you interviewed two folks for it, actually. That's up now at WJFFradio.org. No coincidence, that's where you can also go to make your donation to the station during our fund drive, because we're funded by listeners like you, and the amazing work that our reporters like Julia Kim are able to do is only possible because listeners like you give what they can. So please give now at WJFFradio.org or give us a call, 845 845- 888-482-4141. Julia, can you just talk, why journalism? Why reporting, especially at a time where it seems that journalists and reporters are increasingly under fire? You're a young person, you know, staking your way in life. Why are you choosing this path at this time?
For sure. I mean, it's, I find myself asking that question myself sometimes, but I think, you know, the root of it is, you know, I grew up in a smaller town in Missouri, and what, you know, really struck me about that experience was I just never saw, you know, stories, you know, of my community, of marginalized communities in general being represented in media. And I mean, I can't forget the feeling that I was able to have when I was able to, you know, really engage with information, to engage with stories and engage with history that was very much relevant to me and, you know, my life experiences. And so since that, and like since that moment back in like eighth grade, you know, I started engaging in the journalism program of high school, where I began, you know, reporting and talking about these issues that I found were just so relevant and that weren't always being reported. And that brought me a lot of passion. That brought me a lot of community. I got to meet amazing people, not only in terms of who I'm working with, but in terms of who I'm get to talk to, you know, for my interviews. And that's what really drives me. I mean, we always talk about how access to information is essential to our democracy, but it truly is. I think it's also essential to just living, to, you know, be proud of who you are and our identity. And that was very important for me. And, you know, in the reporting that I've been doing now, I've been able to talk to some amazing people in these local communities. We're able to take these huge, you know, nationwide issues and really see how they're impacting people at the local level. And just, yeah, being able to talk to people has just been an amazing experience. I've learned so much, and I think that's something I love about journalism. It's that as a reporter, you're learning so much. I feel like every story is a new learning curve. It's a new experience. And yeah, I mean, I think working at the intersection of journalism and social justice, you know, it can be hard, very much so. But at the end of the day, like, it means so much to me. And I've been able to see the kind of impact it has been able to have, you know, on people whose, you know, experiences, who the challenges they're facing aren't necessarily being reported on.
All right. Well, Julia Kim, we want to get to your report here at the start of the local edition. So I want to thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And we're going to get right to it. And listener, I'm going to ask you to continue to support the station that enables us to foster this next generation of journalists. Please donate now, WJFFradio.org, or call 845-482-4141. Julia Kim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I had a great time talking to you.
Thousands of New Yorkers are facing long wait lists for two major state-funded mental health programs, supportive housing, as well as assertive community treatment, or ACT. That's according to New York Focus. In Sullivan County alone, every applicant since 2022 has been waitlisted, sometimes for years. Now, that backlog comes as Governor Hochul expanded involuntary commitment in the latest state budget, raising concerns among advocates. Radio Catskills' Julia Kim spoke with Luke Cicchini, Policy Director at Alliance Rights and Recovery, about the delays and the controversy over involuntary treatment. She also spoke with staff and a member of the Hudson Valley Clubhouse in Poughkeepsie about the importance of community-based support models.
21-year-old William DeLuca Sima's journey to becoming a mental health advocate started with his own recovery at the Hudson Valley Clubhouse. DeLuca Sima joined the newly established community-centered mental health program in Poughkeepsie last year in a period of extreme depression. Referred to the clubhouse after a stay in a psychiatric hospital, DeLuca Sima described how the community there, which emphasized connecting people struggling with mental health issues to one another and to critical resources, served as a launch point, propelling his desire to study visual arts at Dutchess Community College and his own advocacy for young adult programming in the clubhouse and community-centered approaches to recovery as a whole.
I feel like I'm useful. Prior to clubhouse, I was in bed 24/7, but here I'm actively participating. I'm creating groups to make other people feel the same way I feel.
The Clubhouse model that DeLuca Sima is a part of is one type of evidence-based, community-centered program here in New York that works to support residents struggling with serious mental health issues. The Hudson Valley Clubhouse is the first of its kind in upstate New York after the original clubhouse was established 75 years ago in New York City. But the major state-funded community-based mental health programs available for New Yorkers are supportive housing, which consists of affordable permanent housing with on-site services, and assertive community treatment, otherwise known as ACT, in which a team of mental health professionals travels to a person's own community to provide mental health support. However, the issue lies in the fact that thousands of New Yorkers, including those living in Dutchess, Orange, and Sullivan counties, are facing long waitlists for supportive housing and ACT. According to an article by New York Focus, every resident in Sullivan County who applied for supportive housing programs in the years 2022, 2023, and 2024 were placed on waitlists of up to a couple of years. Despite funding towards these initiatives having increased over the years, Luke Sikini, Director of Policy at the Alliance of Rights to Recovery, a statewide nonprofit dedicated to mental health advocacy, said that this backlog is because these increases have yet to make up for decades of underfunding for community-based programs and the infrastructure required to run them, in terms of both housing units and staff members. I know you already touched on it a little bit, but I'm wondering if you could go more into why we are dealing with these really long wait lists.
You know, we called for a 7.8% rate enhancement for agencies in their workforce and got about 2.6%, which is underneath inflation for the year, which was at about, I think, 3.1%. So what we're seeing is, you know, through inflation and the lack of investment, agencies are losing dollars, which means agency staff are also very much underpaid. And we see at agencies, you know, up to 30% vacancy rates and often a, you know, 35% or higher turnover rate, which means a lot of these folks can't keep staff for long enough. So even as the state attempts to expand some services, staff aren't there to really provide those services. We see a very high percentage of our mental health and substance use workforce relies on public assistance themselves, because they don't have high enough salary to put food on the table by themselves. So, and what does it really say about our society if the people who take care of the, you know, the vulnerable within our group are the vulnerable themselves, because we haven't put enough investment there.
But waitlists are not the only barrier to these voluntary programs. Blay Sackett, executive director of the Hudson Valley Clubhouse, said more rural communities in the Hudson Valley, such as those in Dutchess and Sullivan counties, have long faced disparities in access due to a lack of adequate transportation, alongside other factors, such as insufficient broadband access and inflexibility of appointment hours. Furthermore, Sarah Santos, who is program director of the Clubhouse, said the logistics of services that are meant to address the predominant need for housing among New Yorkers, but especially those struggling with mental health and substance abuse issues, have proven utterly difficult.
There's a couple different like housing programs that we work with. Section 8 is the one that has the multiple years long wait list. For the most part, in that regard, it seems that the issue is not having enough units, just not having enough for the need. Then there are several other housing programs that we interact with. So Blaze was describing something called temporary assistance, where people are provided a certain amount of money a month to go toward housing. And off the top of my head, the numbers that people are provided, so there's about, it's about $900 for a studio, which there's no studio in this area for $900. But $1,100 for a one-bedroom and $1,200 for a two-bedroom. There's nothing that exists in that realm. And people are, as Blaze described, required to do 10 housing searches a week. And if they don't keep up with that, then their case can be closed and they can be sanctioned, which means they can't access any resources. For sometimes it's a month at a time, can be even more. We also interact with a program called Single Point of Access that is specific to folks that live with a mental health condition. They have to have a psych eval from within a year and from within 6 months, I believe, and medical exam within a year. And a lot of times people get that done and they're sitting in there waiting and the year passes. They don't have housing and they have to start that process all over again. There's another program called Coordinated Entry that takes into account episodes of homelessness. But if someone doesn't have a phone or they lose their phone and they lose touch with their caseworker, their case is closed. So there's also a logistical sort of issue with the way the services are delivered and what we're requiring of individuals, you know, that a lot of times seems like it's not a viable option for them. You know, having to keep up with certain amounts of appointments, again, doing those housing searches, submitting documentation constantly. It's a lot to take on if you're sleeping outside, especially if you live with a mental health condition or a substance use disorder on top of that.
On the policy level, the attention has been, for the most part, not on improving these community-based programs, but rather increasing institutional settings, Sikinyi said.
There's been investment in hospitals. There's been a push to open more beds, but there's been less investment in the services that, you know, make sure that people stay out of the hospitals in the first place. And while we saw some in the state, it is paltry in comparison to what they're pushing for institutional settings. Like, for example, there's $120 million for a new forensic facility on Ward's Island that we might not see for another 5 years. Whereas I think there was less than I can't remember exactly how much, but there was, you know, when you total housing and community services dollars that were new dollars, it was less than $100 million for those new programs.
This comes as Governor Kathy Hochul actually expanded involuntary commitment in the state's latest budget amid fears for public safety in connection to the rise in homelessness in New York City. As to where police and clinicians now have more power to forcibly hospitalize people they deem as experiencing a mental health crisis. Police and clinicians no longer need evidence of imminent risk or recent overt acts to involuntarily commit someone, and individuals can be deemed as susceptible to committing harm based on their, quote, inability to meet basic needs like food, shelter, or medical care. It was a proposal that received significant pushback from mental health organizations like the Alliance of Rights and Recovery because of its linking of mental illness and homelessness to violence and its failure to address the root causes of mental health crises, Sikinyi said. In addition, its increased incorporation of police who are not trained in de-escalating mental health crises, often resorting to violence in the case of Black and Brown individuals, has raised concerns. I know the Alliance of Rights and Recovery was one of the groups that had pushed back against this expansion, and it would be great if you could explain the issues of involuntary commitment as the major solution to addressing mental health issues.
A main reason why we were against this provision is, one, we saw that this was really being called for because of the conflation of violence with people with mental illnesses. And two, the biggest concern is if we are, and as we should be, concerned about folks who are dealing with homelessness, the best way to support them, even if they have a mental illness, is not just a hospitalization for 2 weeks, but rather to get them housing. And, you know, I think we, in a lot of ways, we saw this as a quick policy fix for a much grander problem that does take time and continued investment in both housing and mental health supports in the community. And we also know from our work, you know, I travel throughout the state and visit each region, you know, multiple times a year. And one of the things that we heard consistently was that the two biggest challenges faced by people were lack of affordable housing, which is why there's been a rise in homelessness, and two, lack of access to effective services in the community. So we really saw this as putting our funding and our emphasis on the mental health system in the wrong place within the system. Because hospitals, while they are a component of the mental health system, I think a lot of politicians, the public, the media, put far more focus on hospitals when it comes to mental health than what the real reality of the system is. You know, people go into hospitals, but you know, hospitals do not guarantee sustained recovery. That's really the community-based supports that help you day in, day out, help you maintain housing, help you maintain your services. If you are taking medication, can help you manage doing that. If you're not taking medication, manage, you know, other support services that help you stay healthy and well and in the community.
Although hospitalization can be an important measure to address a mental health crisis, DeLucasima personally described his time in a hospital as, quote, restrictive and stressful in comparison to his experience in the clubhouse. Alongside DeLucasima, Santos said that she has been able to witness firsthand the effectiveness of framing support in terms of connecting people struggling with mental illness to resources that work to address the social determinants of their health.
Yeah, you just like mentioned being able to like witness that development firsthand.
And I was wondering if you kind of go into that, like those personal experiences you've been able to see in terms of the benefits that this community-centered approach has been able to incite in people.
We ended up doing reach out to this individual who showed up on our first Saturday that we were open and had confided in Blaze and I that they were planning on taking their life that day before they came to the clubhouse. We immediately got really involved in their life. They were living on the street. They were disconnected from family. They had nothing. They were staying in a McDonald's. Met the person on that Sunday. And over the course of several weeks, we got the person connected to a mental health provider, a primary care doctor that they went to for the first time in years. Through getting them connected with those services, we were able to get them a accommodation for housing. So they were able to get off the street. From there, they began taking a GED course and got involved in political advocacy on a local level.
Fortunately, state funding is still going towards programs that diverge from volunteer commitment, including clubhouses, but also non-police crisis response pilot programs and peer-to-peer support services. With that being said, Zucchini said that cuts coming down from the federal government, specifically in regards to Medicaid and mental health programs, could exacerbate the current issue.
So we're seeing just that real lack of clear investment, which shows a lack of focus on this area. And it cuts multiple ways, but that is really concerning, especially in the face of possible Medicaid cuts and funding losses from the federal government. So we're seeing more push to institutionalization, less funding for community services, and then Medicaid cuts will also lead more people off of insurance and more towards those high-cost emergency and institutional sort of settings.
I just spoke with Luke Zucchini, Director of Policy at the Alliance of Rights and Recovery, as well as William DeLucasima, Sarah Santos, and Blaze Sackett at the Hudson Valley Clubhouse on the issues of long waitlists for community-based mental health programs and the expansion of a voluntary commitment in New York.
And thank you to Julia Kim for that report. This is a local edition, and it's on Radio Catskill. We're listener-supported radio, and I'm asking you now to support a great investigative journalism like this that we're able to do here. Julia Kim, working for Radio Catskill, doing that exclusive deep dive into the state of mental health in our area. Donate now at WJFFradio.org or give us a call, 845-482-4141. Well, next up, is the U.S. president above the law? That's what Patricio Rubio wanted to find out when he spoke to Michael Kirk, award-winning filmmaker and founding producer of Frontline. His latest documentary is called Trump's Power and the Rule of Law. It explores how the idea that no one is above the law is being tested like never before.
Covered him, in his first term. He's the fifth or sixth president, depends on how you count him, that I've been covering. In the first term, he was just like completely kind of lost. Didn't feel like there was any coherence. There was no strategy, no big idea. In this one, basically from the very beginning, that night in Washington where he goes into the arena and he's throwing pens and signing executive orders, I thought to myself, this is something different. This feels coherent. Then he goes back to the Oval Office and he signs the pardons for 1,500 people who had attacked the Capitol building during January 6th. And I thought, well, this is not just a staged thing. He's got an idea going here. We've, as I say, covered him plenty and covered many presidents. We always can kind of get inside. So we figured it out. What is he doing? Is this Steve Bannon called it Days of Thunder. Is it just noise? Or is there something going on here that we should pay attention to? And it didn't take very long before we realized there was a big film that needed to be made, a big story that needed to be told to the American people about 6 months out about what was he doing? And was it just noise and chaos and fear and anger and revenge and all the things that words that have been applied? Or was it those things and something else? And it's the something else that this film's about.
Right. And the title puts the power and the rule of law in tension. There are maybe two different forces there. You don't always pull in the same direction sometimes.
Right.
If you want to talk about what does your film say about what happens when personal power begins to sort of overpower the legal boundaries?
It's been, you know, it's been an argument that's been going on in America since the very beginning. Alexander Hamilton said, I want a very strong executive. I want the executive to have all the power, and the Congress and the courts thinking, yeah, they can keep things going, but the president's going to have to drive it. It's going to take real leadership. Whether he was thinking of George Washington or not, I don't know. He may not have been thinking about Donald Trump if he would have laid the example before him, but he might have been. You know, he might have said, listen, if 70 million or 75 million Americans vote for the president of the United States, he's got a mandate. If the Supreme Court has given him a decision last summer, which is essentially the greatest decision ever given a president, which is you have absolute immunity from doing anything as president of the United States. That's rocket fuel to a guy like Donald Trump, who likes to operate out in the open, unlike Lyndon Johnson or somebody who break heads and, you know, knock heads and break kneecaps privately. This is a guy who's right out. He's out there all in the wide open. And every president has wanted to expand their power. Every president has done everything they could to, you know, connive and cajole and threaten and do whatever they have to do to get the Congress to get out of the way. They've appointed judges that they hope will support whatever they want to do. That's an ongoing part of the democracy, and it functions. And in some ways, even during the chaos of the early 6 months of Trump, the courts have, you know, the federal courts, hundreds of cases against the president, saying no, a lot of the immigration cases, no. The courts, judges appointed by Obama, by Reagan, by Trump himself, by Bush, by everybody, they sort of without ideology have found in favor of or against the president of the United States. But this guy and the people around him are really determined this time to go out and test it as far as it can go. And that means they're heading for the United States Supreme Court. And as we've seen in the last week or two, in some ways, the Supreme Court is sending back down to the lower courts adjustments that say, hey, you can't, wait a minute, you can't constrain a president from firing the people who work for him, for example. That's most of the people in the government. You can't stop him from doing this and that and this and that. But when it comes to the rubber meets the road phrase, due process, do you have the right, do I have the right to face my accuser and say, here's my excuse for what you think I did, or I wasn't there, or that's not me, or I'm not a gang member. You know, I don't have a record in Salvador or Venezuela or Mexico. You got the wrong guy. That's the moment that everybody who's watching, everybody on every side, we talk to conservative judges, we talk to liberal judges, we talk to all kinds of people. That's the moment they're all headed for, is when, if that gets to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court says, well, we like you, we're conservatives, you know, and you're John Roberts. I know I gave you an immunity thing, but Mr. President, I got to say you're going too far here. Either on due process or something else like it, you got to obey this court order that says bring them back, or whatever it is. When that moment comes, that's when people tell us the constitutional crisis will be at hand, because Trump's people say he will not blink at that moment. Steve Bannon tells us in the film he will not blink. He will not, in other words, do what the Supreme Court tells him to do. And if that's the case, Then we're at that showdown moment where the democracy, our belief in the rule of law, is really in peril.
Right. Now you talk about the word constitutional crisis. You give context. You talk about Watergate, Nixon, and you see the films when they were calling that time a constitutional crisis. Right. And you sort of answered this question already, Michael. But you know, do you think the U.S. has crossed into that sort of constitutional crisis during Trump's term, or are we still edging towards one?
Yeah, the people we talk to, very conservative former appeals court justice Michael Luttig, for example, said, we're on the way. It seems almost inevitable because the judges, he said to us, will not back down. They can't. They don't have an army, but they have the law. And if they feel that this is against the law, they have an obligation to act, to do whatever that means, the right thing, enforce the law. And the president, if he thinks the law is not important, not something that gets in, if he thinks it's something that gets in the way of his power, his ability to do what he wants to do. And in the case of immigration, for example, if that's where we land, it's he feels that the American, he's picked a case, he's picked immigration intentionally. He knows that that's the big issue. A lot of Americans.